Hi, I'm Misha Ketchell, editor of The Conversation. For democracy to work, people need to be well informed. That's why we work with academic experts to share their research and explain issues in the news. Everything we do is free to republish, but we need your support. Please donate to The Conversation by going to donate.theconversation.com or following the link in the show notes.
Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is The Conversation's Politics Podcast. The Greens have had a changing of the guard, with Victorian Senator Richard Di Natale replacing Christine Milne. The government, as it seeks to negotiate on its budget measures in the Senate, is hoping that the new leader will be more flexible than his predecessor. Richard Di Natale, you've had a few weeks to settle in as leader of the Greens. How are you adjusting to the new role, do you think?
Oh, well, it's been a fairly wild ride, I suppose. The first few weeks have been a bit of a whirlwind. Big shoes to fill. Christine did an incredible job, and of course, coming on the back of Bob. So I've got two previous leaders that it's going to be difficult to live up to. Very busy, not getting much sleep, but really incredible opportunity to do some good
challenge?
Things.
What's the biggest
challenge? Do you mean personally, or do you mean, in a professional sense?
Well, both. Personally,
okay.
To start with.
I think personally is just to make sure you've got enough time to do the things that keep you grounded and enough time to see the family, the kids, all that sort of stuff. So actually trying to get that mythical work-life balance thing happening, that's tough. Professionally, look, I mean, as a new leader, it's important for me to establish a profile. I think it's fair to say I'm not particularly well known to the electorate, so that's a challenge. But I'm pretty confident. We've got a very good story to tell. I think our message resonates with a lot of people, and so I'll spend the next few months doing a tour of the country and letting people know who I am and what I stand for.
As you say, you're not very well known. There was a lot of speculation when you came in about whether the Greens would be more flexible or not under your stewardship. Will they be?
It'll be, I think, issue by issue. Look, I got into the business to get stuff done. I didn't want to be someone who was watching from the sidelines. I think where we can get a good outcome for the community, whether it's an Abbott government, a Shorten government, then I'm prepared to work with them to get a good outcome for the community. I think we've got an opportunity on a few measures, a few of the budget measures, other issues where I've been talking to the government, issues like fuel indexation. I've spoken to them, and we're having a conversation to see whether there's any room for them to move and to get something that I think we can both live with.
Do you think you can get a deal there?
Look, it's going to be as much up to the government as it is up to us. I've already said that we won't support the fuel indexation measure unless the government is prepared to negotiate. The problem with the fuel indexation measure, I know there's an assumption that the Greens would support an increase in the cost of petrol, but there are conditions on that. You've got to give people alternatives, and that's why I think there's got to be some money for public transport. And you've also got to recognise it is a regressive measure. It does affect poor people more than it affects people on higher incomes, and so we need to deal with that as well.
Now, your objection, the Greens' objection, has been that this money was earmarked for roads and you thought it should be given to public transport. But on the other side, it has been brought in by regulation. The government will need legislation to validate that within a few months. But if it's blocked in the Senate, the money that's already been collected goes back to the oil companies. Do you really want that to happen?
Well, it's up to the government as to whether they want that to happen. And as I've said, it's not the Greens that will be giving this money back. It is the government that will be making a decision that in the context of what they previously described as a budget emergency, that they're prepared to hand over a lot of money to big oil companies. It will be their call. I hope it doesn't get to that point. What I do hope is that they do acknowledge that if you're going to introduce a pollution tax, you've got to also provide people with alternatives. No point having a pollution tax if there aren't alternatives. And you've got to address the regressive nature of it. We did that with the carbon price. We raised the tax-free threshold, and we put a lot of money into renewable energy options through the Clean Energy Finance Corporation. We need to do something similar when it comes to fuel indexation.
Well, perhaps many people would say that you stopped a carbon price coming in initially, which meant that when it did come in, it was all too late and easier to reverse.
Well, it was. We actually got we blocked a bad policy and introduced a much better one. It became law, and
now
we had
got no policy on it.
Yes, but that logic presupposes that we should not adopt a stronger policy. We should go with a weaker one, because at some point in the future, the stronger policy might be repealed. So I think we made the right call there. It was a tough call. We ended up with one of the most, I think, ambitious and powerful climate change laws anywhere in the world. And it was Tony Abbott who effectively came to power and reversed those. But I'm confident that we'll get Australia back on track when it comes to climate change.
Now, have you had a meeting with Tony Abbott yet?
I have.
And how did that go?
It was, I think, constructive, straight to the point. We indicated that I indicated to the Prime Minister that where there was an area where there might be some common ground and where I felt we could get a good outcome for the community, then we should look at those and talk about them.
Now, turning to gay marriage, after the Irish referendum result, the prospect of legalising marriage equality in Australia seems to have substantially improved, one would think. Bill Shorten is introducing a bill on the issue next week. The Greens already have a bill in the Senate, but there's now some suggestion that the Shorten move might be counterproductive, leading to a Liberal backlash. Do you think that's a danger?
Look, it's a small danger, but I don't think it's a... We are going to get reform in this area. We will see discrimination ended in the area of marriage soon. I suspect there's a good chance it'll happen this year, and I think that it will be long overdue. What we need to do is put the politics behind us. I've already written to the Prime Minister today and indeed to the opposition leader and suggested that we get together, that we take the partisanship out of this issue, that we come up with some legislation that we can put to the Parliament, we have a genuine debate, and we effectively end discrimination once and for all.
Do you think that the Liberal Party will eventually allow a conscience vote?
Yes, I do. I think it's inevitable.
Did you discuss this at all with the Prime Minister?
No, the meeting with the Prime Minister was several weeks ago, and we didn't talk about the issue of same-sex marriage.
And if there is a conscience vote on the part of the Liberals, do you think the numbers are there for the bill to pass, or a bill to pass?
I think at the moment it's quite close. I suspect that what you'll find is, as the debate gathers steam and as public opinion begins to exert itself, those people who have been sitting on the fence or who are concerned about the election that's around the corner will, I think, support the change, and we will end up with this reform passing the Parliament.
I guess that the people who contact the Greens offices are overwhelmingly pro.
If you look at public support just through published opinion polls, over 60% of the community, and growing. You look at what happened in Ireland. You look at a very staunchly Catholic country. There is strong public support for this, and I think ultimately we'll get this over the line.
But do you think that in marginal seats, the opponents of marriage equality will be able to exert real pressure on members?
They'll try, but I don't think that the lobby against same-sex marriage is anywhere near as strong as the voices in support of it. And in the end, public opinion tends to win out, particularly the closer you get to an election. So I'm sure we'll get this through. And it's just something that we should end discrimination. We should put the issue behind us and move on. I mean, we've been debating this for far too long. Australia is being left behind when it comes to ending discrimination in marriage.
Now, there was talk a couple of weeks ago in the wake of the budget about the possibility of an election this year. It subsided somewhat, but do you think there is a prospect of Tony Abbott going quickly to the polls?
Oh, of course there is. There's a prospect. The question is,
this year even?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, how likely is it? I suspect it's less than a 50-50 bet, but it's still a possibility. We have every single election that I can remember. There's speculation about an early election, a double dissolution. They they more often than not don't happen. But you can't count that out. And so we're prepared for an early election. I think it's more likely to be next year. In the end, the polls will dictate it. If the coalition surge ahead in the polls and Abbott sees it as an opportunity to secure his prime ministership, then I think, you know, we will head to an election. But at this stage, I'd rate it less than a 50-50 chance.
It would be a double dissolution. You have 9 senators at the moment. How would you go in a double dissolution?
It would be difficult in some states. So I think overall our numbers wouldn't change that much.
You'd be worse off though, wouldn't you?
Well, it depends. It depends where the national vote goes. It would at the moment. It's fair to say that in states like South Australia and Queensland, we have, you know, a tough job ahead of us in holding on to them. In a double dissolution, we'd win both of those. What would then be in jeopardy is those states where we've got a second senator, and that would make those people who are number two on the Senate ticket in those states like Victoria, Western Australia, and Tasmania, it would make it a little more difficult for those people, but not impossible.
Now, this week, the government has announced plans to revoke the citizenship of dual citizens who are involved in terrorism overseas or at home. This would be at the discretion of the immigration minister. Where do the Greens stand on this?
Oh, huge concerns about this. Huge concerns. I don't think that anything we've seen recently from this government makes Australia any safer. I think the first duty of the Prime Minister should be to keep Australians safe. Standing up and having a press conference announcing that you're going to give special titles to members of parliament, appointing bureaucrats to positions, that doesn't do anything to keep Australia safe. In fact, I'd say it does the opposite. I think what it does is it makes Australians more anxious and fearful, particularly with the sort of language that's being used by this Prime Minister. Then when you get to the issue of citizenship, and when you hear that there was a discussion in Cabinet about revoking citizenship for people born in Australia, effectively suggesting that we would render them stateless, it shows you just where this debate has gone.
The government would say that you wouldn't be rendering those people stateless because it would be people who were eligible for citizenship elsewhere.
Well, we're a global citizen. What are we suggesting would happen? Are we saying that we would prefer to have, rather than have somebody face the criminal justice system and be in jail, we would rather see them being sent back to a country where they're engaged in violence? And what happens if every country adopts this attitude? If every country was to adopt the attitude that Australia did, the system couldn't work. We would have a huge number of people who would be rendered stateless. It's irresponsible. It's dangerous. And it will be ineffective. We've got an opportunity to use those people who come back here as a tool against radicalisation. Of course, they need to face criminal penalties if they've broken the law, and they should be strong penalties. But let's not, for a moment, pretend that revoking a person's citizenship does anything to keep us safer.
Do you think that the government is just using this issue for political purposes?
It's always, I think, dangerous ground to impugn motives on individuals or on a group of individuals. There's no question that in a national security environment, political environment, that it is the government of the day that stands to benefit from that. I'm not going to suggest that this government is using the issue for political purposes. It, of course, has to be a concern for everybody. And in the end, my focus is on what it is that's going to keep Australians safe. And we know that there are programs that work within the community. We know that there are a range of outreach programs. Working with those communities affected directly is the best measure in terms of prevention. And we're not doing that. We're spending all our money funding mass surveillance programs through things like data retention, law enforcement, and we're not spending anywhere near the sort of funds that are necessary in working with those communities and preventing this problem.
Can you totally prevent it, though, given the strength of the Islamic State overseas?
I don't think you can totally prevent it, but you can certainly improve the situation at the moment. And the people who are most affected are members of the Islamic community. I mean, they're living in fear for their children, and the influence that that this is having on them. We need to work with them. We need to work with leaders within that community. We need to work with the youth outreach programs. And that's the way you're going to address it. You don't address it by standing up at a press conference surrounded by flags, appointing people as special envoys, bringing in bureaucrats. That's not what it might get you some good copy. It might make the lead of a number of the news bulletins. It doesn't keep Australia safe.
Now, on another topic, the Coalition has introduced legislation to cut back the renewable energy target. You obviously disagree with this, but isn't it just a recognition of reality that that target would not have been able to be met, and will it make a great deal of difference?
Yes, it will. It'll make a huge difference. And no, the reality was that we would have seen increased investment had the target, if this target was high, we'd see more solar farms built. We would see more wind farms built. We would see more of the sort of technology that's necessary to combat climate change, to create jobs and to transform the economy. This is an announcement that's bad for jobs, it's bad for the climate, and it's a disaster for the environment, because part of this legislation now is to allow the burning of native forests and call that renewable energy. We're looking at some of the power now that will be generated through the burning of native forests, which means more logging, more destruction of endangered wildlife, and giving a lifeline to an industry that was on the way out. This is something that this deal between Tony Abbott and Bill Shorten is a bad deal, and it's been made worse by the inclusion today of the native forest component. I think the Labor Party need to walk away from it. And Bill Shorten's first test, in my view, of his support for the environment will be whether he walks away from this deal and, in particular, does not support the burning of native forests.
Just to come back to negotiations in the Senate, the government wants a trade-off for its childcare package by having cuts to the family tax benefit scheme. Are you involved in these talks, and do you think that a deal will be reached where at least some cutbacks will be enabled to be passed the Senate?
I've had a discussion with the Prime Minister and the Treasurer about this. Some of the childcare reforms are quite good. We like some of the childcare package. We think it's one of the few positive measures in the budget. But why would you force the Senate to choose between taking money from one group of people? So the family tax benefit changes take support away from single parents. If you're a single mother doing it tough, you're effectively holding a ransom note next to the Senate to say, we'll take support away from that person in order to fund the childcare package. We don't like it. We think the linking those things are unnecessary and presenting Australia with false choices. Why not look at superannuation tax concessions? Why not look at negative gearing? Why not look at some of the huge subsidies that go predominantly to people on high incomes, to the big end of town? And why would you target people like single mothers? We shouldn't be forced to make those choices, and we won't support the changes to family tax benefits as they stand.
You won't support any change, though? For example, one proposal from the government is that the benefit would cut out when the youngest child is 6. Well, what about if it was changed to be 8 or 12?
It still removes support. I mean, at 8 or 12, as a parent, you've got a responsibility to look after your kids, and it still removes support from sole parents, which is why we don't like it. If there's some targeting, some tighter targeting in family tax benefit B, then we'd look at that in terms of support flowing to people on high incomes. But this is not the area to be looking for savings. There are other areas that we can look at savings. But more importantly, why not look at the revenue side of the equation? Who says that where we are at the moment is the right ratio when you look at tax to GDP? We're actually quite a low-taxing country relative to other nations. And in my view, I think there is a strong argument to say superannuation has become a vehicle for people on high incomes to minimise tax. We need to fix it. Negative gearing has meant that property prices are spiralling out of control, unreachable for young people. And give a huge tax break to people on high incomes. We should fix that. Why not introduce a small levy on the big banks, end the diesel fuel subsidy that's worth $10 billion over the Ford estimates. There are so many areas where we don't have to target people on low incomes.
In general, we should be paying somewhat more tax and cutting spending less.
Well, I think that you don't need to take a dogmatic view about this. My view is, in the current circumstances, looking at saving money by taking benefits away from single parents, as opposed to removing a subsidy that goes to the mining industry in the form of cheap diesel. Well, that's a straightforward choice for me. Why are we giving billions of dollars in the form of cheap fuel to miners? And so they're the sort of choices I think we should be asking ourselves, rather than let's fund childcare and the only way to do it is by hurting single parents.
Now, just finally, there's talk about legislation to change the Senate voting arrangements, essentially to stop micro parties getting in as frequently as they do. And in principle, the Greens support this. Have you had talks with the government or the opposition on this, either you or Christine Milne before you?
Yes, we have. And I've had some preliminary discussions with members of the government. Look, we've got people elected in the parliament who are elected under a system that's undemocratic. That's not to say I haven't enjoyed, and I think in some ways it's refreshing to have different voices in the Senate. That's a good thing, and I'd like to see more of it. But they have to be elected democratically, and to have somebody elected on the back of backroom preference deals isn't a democratic system, and I think Senate voting reform needs to happen.
And do you think this legislation's imminent? Where is it?
Well, I've called this the canary in the coal mine. The moment you see this legislation introduced into the parliament, get ready for an election. This will be the first sign that we're heading to the polls. So it really does depend on when the election is. I think what we'll see is this will be the last bit of legislation. They don't want to rile the Senate, and so they'll leave this to the very end.
Everyone will be on the watch out.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Richard Di Natale. That's all for the Conversations Politics podcast for today. Thank you to my producer, Matt Dawson. We'll be back again with another interview soon. This is Michelle Grattan.
I was saved by God to make America great again.
An autocrat loves a crisis. A crisis is the way that they mobilize their base.
While America is under invasion from within, we're under invasion from within.
He's testing the boundaries of what he can get away with.
We should use some of these dangerous cities as training grounds for our military, National Guard, but military.
We've asked six of the world's preeminent scholars how we can measure the make of an autocrat. It's a recipe of sorts, tried and tested by the most infamous leaders in history.
Hugo Chavez in Venezuela.
Vladimir Putin in Russia.
Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler.
Viktor Orban in Hungary.
He's basically bulletproof in terms of criminal prosecution.
Join us from December 29 as we explore Trump, the making of an autocrat, from The Conversation.